now. Detonate the reality bomb!
Change has come to America.
Some alien race to come down and threaten us.
Is the singularity near?
The military-industrial complex.
The truth is out there.
The seven mountains of the influencers of culture.
To be as gods, you know,
catapult the propaganda.
From a mostly secure, undisclosed, split-level location on a cul-de-sac somewhere in the heartland of America, this is A View from the Bunker. Now, here's Derek Gilbert.
September is National Preparedness Month, and one of the things that we Christians may need to prepare for is actual armed conflict. Welcome to A View from the Bunker. Our guest is the host of the Prepper Recon podcast, PrepperRecon.com, and he's also authoring a line of novels in a new genre, what you'd call prepper fiction. His new book is the third in a series called The Days of Noah. This is The Days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition. We welcome back to the bunker, Mark Goodwin. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Derek, it's so good to be back on. Thanks for having me.
This is a real exciting read. I'm only partway through, but it jumps in at the speed of a roller coaster and doesn't really let up. Lots of explosions. This is the kind of fiction I think that men would probably appreciate more than women. Just speaking personally, I tend to have more explosions and car chases and stuff when I write fiction than my wife, who tends to write more about people sitting around and having coffee and donuts. But there is quite a lot of action in The Days of Noah. And again, it starts off with almost a literal bang. How likely is it, in your view, that Christians are going to face a time when we have to take up guns?
Well, I guess 10 years ago, if you would have asked me, you know, will anybody ever go to prison for being a Christian in America, I would have probably thought no. But I guess Kim Davis's ordeal has changed that for everybody. Hmm. So it's looking more and more like we are the new persecuted class in America, and I don't expect that trend to be reversed anytime soon. We've seen, of course, the bakers and florists and wedding chapels and all of them facing civil trials for refusing to perform services for sodomites and same-sex marriages. So I don't know. At this point, it's if we continue the trend, and I don't see anything that's going to reverse it, it's starting to look more and more likely that we will be pushed to that point.
Hmm. The protagonist of the book, Noah Parker, is married to his wife, who aptly named Cassandra. And I think we discussed this in our previous interview. Cassandra, of course, in Greek mythology, was the oracle who was doomed to not have anyone listen to her ever.
Right.
Although it seems in the days of Noah, finally people have awakened, and Noah is finally on board and understands the seriousness of the gravity of the situation. Based on where we are now, what kind of thought process, how far-fetched, and I guess maybe this is another way of asking the question I just asked, do you think, how wrong will things have to go from where we are now to get to the point where Noah and Cassandra Parker and their friends are in the Days of Noah series?
Well, in the first book, I sort of picked it up at today's headlines, and I just sort of projected it forward into the future for the next few, you know, it takes a little longer than it did in Noah, because it was a matter of months from book one to book three. So I hope we've got a little bit more time than that. But I don't know. I think the next election's coming that could be a big mile marker for us. If we get somebody like a Bernie Sanders in there, I think that we could see the persecution of the church really, really pick up. And things to get really, really rough in a hurry. Hmm. Otherwise, I think that, you know, we might have another 5, 10, 15 years. I don't know.
I haven't paid that much attention to Bernie Sanders, really, because I just thought Bernie Sanders was a phenomenon localized to Vermont. But apparently, the Democrats now have, well, Hillary Clinton, for all the money that she is spending, is finding that people just really don't like her. What is Bernie Sanders about, and how much of a threat does he really oppose to people of faith?
Well, he calls himself a socialist, which when you strip it out, it's really communist, because the Democrats are actually the socialists. So we've already got that socialist party going with the welfare state and the things that they want to put forth. But I think that he would be looking for something that would be much more what we would call communism, as far as redistribution of wealth and state control. And and we've seen the marginalization and demonization of Christians, and I think that he would be somebody really good to push that to the next level, and I think that most any Democratic candidate would probably take it to the next level as well, but probably not to the same degree that a Bernie Sanders would. And I don't have a whole lot of hope for many of the Republican candidates as far as like turning back the dial and standing up for religious freedoms, to where the Kim Davises and the sweet cake bakeries and florists and so on and so forth are able to have their religious liberty. And of course, there was the Marine that was court-martialed, and I can't remember her name. It was a young lady for having "no weapon formed against me shall prosper." She had that verse on her desk, and she refused to take it away because she thought, I'm a Marine. I'm fighting for liberty. I'm protecting people's freedoms. I should have at least that basic First Amendment right. Obviously, on the military bases now, they've lost their Second Amendment rights. Most soldiers, that I don't think they realize that when they sign up, but on the bases, they're not allowed to be armed unless they're a military police officer. And in the most recent shooting in Tennessee, the soldier is actually being charged with a crime for discharging a weapon on a military installation. So self-defense.
I'm flabbergasted. That's the only word that applies here. They're charging him with illegal use of a firearm when somebody was shooting at them.
Correct.
Great googly moogly. Have we lost our collective minds?
We threw it away a long time ago. So that's why I don't think that my books are really that far of a stretch from reality.
Wow.
And of course we've had the MIAC report years back that labeled returning veterans pro-lifers, constitutionalists, labeled them all as potential terror suspects.
The interesting thing about the MIAC report is I actually heard from somebody at MIAC back when I was hosting the Daily Talk Show in Columbia every afternoon, weekday afternoons. We covered the Jefferson City area. And I would open every program with a 5-minute, what I called intelligence briefing, which is basically news stories that I thought were being underreported. The kind of thing that goes into the Skywatch TV daily reports now. And one of the gentlemen at MIAC contacted me off the air, wanted to know where I was getting my information, wanted to know what my intelligence sources were, because I was talking about things that they thought were useful, wanted to know where I was like, Associated Press, UPI, Reuters, it's open sourced. You just have to pay attention. I just thought that was kind of interesting. I actually showed up on the MIAC radar at one point about 10 years ago. How awake are most Christians? How alert are most Christians to the changes that have taken place in our culture over the last 10 years?
I would say 90% of them either attend a church that is either apostate or asleep. And I think that you maybe have 10% that are actually going to a church where their pastor is actually involved in the fight and speaking out against these issues. And, we've seen so many that were so quick to sign on to the gay marriage ruling that, and embrace it and think of it as a, you know, oh yeah, well, you know, that greasy grace syndrome that, you know, God loves you just as you are. And yes, he does, but he loves you too much to leave you like that. And then you've had this other huge segment that they're not apostate. They realize that that's sin, and then, and that they shouldn't, that they're not planning to perform gay weddings, but they're not doing anything proactive to be ready for that, and they're not speaking out against the issues with Kim Davis and all of these other issues that we've got going on. Mm-hmm. So and they're just asleep, and I think that they're going to be really, really caught off guard. And I think what's going to happen is that they're going to find themselves either in civil court or criminal court. And I think that they're not going to be ready for that level of persecution, because I think that they haven't been paying attention, and I think that they've been lulled to sleep, and they think that we still live in a free country.
Hmm. What do you consider to be the most significant changes over the last, well, decade or two as far as our freedoms as Americans?
Well, I guess the Patriot Act is huge.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's astounding, that all of the revelations we got from Snowden, and of course there was information about the data collection that was going on U.S. citizens wholesale prior to Snowden's revelations.
Oh, yeah, USA Today wrote an article about it in May of 2006. So, you know, 7 years before Snowden, the whistleblower, whose name escapes me now, who pointed out that secret room at AT&T's offices in San Francisco was made public. But for some reason, it became a major story in, was it 2013 or was it last year? 2013, I guess it was. Which just leads me to believe that the fact that it came to light at all was just part of some ongoing turf war inside the intelligence community. That's just my theory. But you're right.
And all of that information came out, and the American public did nothing.
Yeah.
It became
a joke.
We've been slaughtering babies in this country. You know, of course, the revelations of the sale of their body parts is just that much more horrendous. But since 1973, we've been slaughtering these children in this country to the tune of something like 3,800 a day. And American pastors don't see the need to get politically involved. So I don't know what it would take to wake up the church, to wake up America, to wake up the remnant that still respects freedom and still would like to see some semblance of what the greatness that this country used to have restored. I don't see what would be the catalyst for that. If we don't see the murdering of 60 million children since Roe versus Wade, if we don't see the wholesale collection of our data, I mean, do you think that anybody's really going to say anything when they start doing door-to-door gun confiscations, which have already happened? That happened in Louisiana after mm-hmm. Katrina, so there's already precedent for that, and nobody did anything then. I think that we're pretty much just going to sit back and let the government do whatever they want to do,
and claim it. Romans 13 compels them to do so.
Yeah, which Romans 13 is about a legitimate government, and you know there is no authority except that which God's instituted. But our ultimate authority in this country is the Constitution, and we've got an entire Senate, House, and executive and judicial branch that are paying zero attention to that document. So
yes.
If you want to talk about who the rebels are, who the anti-government people are, it's the people in Washington, D.C., because they're paying no mind whatsoever to the supreme law of the land.
Yeah, that is true. In discussing the issue of preparation with Carl Gallups a few weeks ago, we had to get into the discussion of gun ownership, gun safety, and that sort of thing. And I'll have to pose the question to you, because I know people will ask and want to know your justification for this. And to be honest, Carl, there were some comments at the YouTube page for Skywatch TV after the interviews with Carl Gallup's posted. People who just don't either see enough of a need, first of all, or secondly, just have an issue with guns, period. In the days of Noah, there is quite a bit of, well, violence. There's no other way around it. Armed resistance to an oppressive state on the part of those who are the heroes, the protagonists in the story. What is the biblical basis, biblical justification for armed resistance, violent resistance to an oppressive government?
Well, Paul tells Timothy that a man that doesn't provide for his own family is worse than an infidel or an unbeliever. And if you're going to provide for your family, what good does it do you to bring home a bag of groceries if you're just going to allow somebody to kick in your door and steal your groceries, rape your wife, and kidnap your child? You know, if you're not, if you can't provide for their basic safety, I don't think that you're really providing for them. And I think that goes a step further than just providing for their safety as well. I think that you owe it to your family to be politically involved and to be part of the political process, at least part of the political conversation. You know, even if you don't think your vote's doing anything, I think that you need to be out there and you need to be in the fight on some level of trying to turn back the tide of what's happening to this country. And I think that's part of providing for your family is providing for them a decent country to live in and at least doing what you can to try to affect that change. And you know, certainly to provide for their immediate safety. You know, in Detroit, the 9/11 response time is something like 58 minutes for a high priority crime. So you're basically talking about somebody that's going to bring a body bag about the same time that rigor mortis is setting in. So you're not there. There's no way that that the police can keep us safe 24 hours a day. You know, we don't have enough police, thank God, to have one in your home 24 hours a day watching over you and keeping you safe, because and it's not their job. That's our own independent responsibility.
What is that point? You use the phrase you know, in the fight, and I suspect that's somewhat metaphorical, because in the fight, as you referred to political action earlier, can also mean being active for causes or candidates who uphold biblical values. But what is that point at which you say, at this point, we no longer have a choice. We need to take up arms.
Well, I guess it was in 1973 when Roe versus Wade passed. So we're 42 years overdue. If you're asking what my standard would be for it, you know, I think that's just such a horrendous thing. And you know, it's certainly, you know, we need some leadership to step up. And I think that we're past the point.
Now, just to clarify that, because again, I know that there are people who are hearing this who might say, "Well, gosh, he's advocating, you know, violent action against abortionists." You want to spell that out a little more clearly, or is that in fact what you're saying?
Well,
and I'm not trying to set this up as a gotcha, because again, I'm just trying to clarify, because there will be people who will be more than happy to take things out of context that we say and use it to tar us with a very broad brush.
Yeah, I think that the ministers in America, I think that that's probably where the brunt of the responsibility falls. You know, because we should have been able to take this back politically. But at this point, I don't really know what the solution is. You know, do we need a military coup? I mean, I don't know. Would that do any good if this president was elected by more than 50% of the people that turned out at the polls? You know, we were supposed to be a Christian country, but, you know, how many people that call themselves Christians have voted for the present administration and so many other administrations that have continued to allow Roe versus Wade to go unchallenged through some type of personhood act or some type of personhood amendment that would give the rights of a citizen to the unborn, which would nullify the entire argument of Roe versus Wade once you declare that they're a person,
An executive order by the president could have done it, and I'm talking about President Bush.
Yeah, and President Bush had for 4 years he had the House and the Senate fully Republican and did nothing. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess I suspect that we won't really see a lot more Edward Snowden's and people that are willing to stick their neck out because the American public has just sat back and done nothing. And, why should they, why should I be forced to live in exile when nobody else is going to do anything, And so I think we're getting ready to run out of heroes. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting ready to run out of people that are willing to stick their neck out, because when they do, the American public does nothing. They just go right back to sleep. They tist and then, mm-hmm. and they go straight back to sleep and they pay no attention to it. So I don't know. I don't think an armed conflict would really do anything. I think that the school system, the socialized welfare system, Hollywood has so brainwashed us, and the American pastorate has sat back and done nothing and said nothing and gave seeker friendly messages for so long that I think that it's pretty much too late, and I think that there's nothing but some type of a judgment type event from God himself that's really going to shake us up enough to wake us up and get us to pay attention. And I think that's probably still on the table. We made it through Shemitah, but I still don't think that God's going to sit back and be mocked too much longer. And even if he were going to give us another 100 years to continue poking our thumb in his eye, we've got such a horrific monetary policy going right now. We've got so much debt mounted up. We've got so much instability in the markets. We've got, I've heard numbers now like $2 trillion in derivatives that are just waiting to blow up. And it just takes such a small catalyst. I was very surprised that we made it through a couple weeks ago when we had the 1,100 points down on the intraday trading on the Dow. I was very surprised that didn't trigger some type of an event. And I think that we had the plunge protection team fully implementing every tool at their disposal. They even brought in David Faber and Jim Cramer in the early show of CNBC. And here we are, 1,100 points down. Of course, that's nearly 400 points over the largest down day on the Dow ever in history. And they're both sitting there telling everybody that it's a normal market pullback and it's a great buying opportunity. There was nothing normal or great about it. It looked like the end of the world as we know it, but they talked the market off the cliff, with their lies and deception, and everybody bought into it. And I guess it's bought us a little more time, but someday they're not going to be able to do that.
Yeah. And you're echoing things that I've heard in recent weeks from the likes of Chuck Missler and Carl Gallups regarding a judgment event on the way. In fact, Chuck was very direct and tied it to the abortion issue, as you did, saying that it's shocking, but the most dangerous place for an American today is not Ramadi. It's not the streets of Chicago. It is in the mother's womb. 1 in 5 chance that an unborn American child will die by her mother's choice or his mother's choice before he or she is born. In New York City, the odds are even worse, especially for African-American babies. More than 50%, more than half the African-American children in the womb in New York City will die before birth. And that is just astonishing. I'm just reminded of the verse, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay." And when he does, it's not going to be pretty. The changes in the markets, the economic difficulties that we've seen over the past few years, since about 2007, 2008, we've never really gone away. We've never really climbed out of that recession. The government says that unemployment most recent month was 5.1%, which the Federal Reserve considers full employment. You can only laugh at that. Talking about preparation, as we are, even though it's getting toward the end of it, we are in the middle of National Preparedness Month. As you say, there will be a time, Mark, when we will go over the cliff instead of coming down off the cliff. Cooler heads won't prevail. How do we as Christians get ready for that type of an event?
Well, you start with yourself because you're your number one survival tool. You know, there's so many people who have got bunkers full of food and water and guns and ammo, and they can't get up off the couch. So you gotta get some exercise. You gotta get your heart going. You know, try to do something to get your heart rate up for at least 30 minutes a day, whether it's a brisk walk or a jog, or if you got bad knees, join a gym and do an elliptical glider, which is so much easier on the joints than running or jogging. Swimming's great. That works just about every muscle in your body. Get your heart rate going, and it's very, very low impact on your joints. And of course, before all of that, it's spiritual preparedness. You know, every 10 out of 10 people die, and you're going to meet your maker someday, no matter how many beans, bullets, and band-aids you have. That day is going to come. So you want to make sure that you're right with God, and that, you've accepted the blood of Christ to cover and get rid of the sin that's going to stop you from being able to get into the kingdom. And so that's the number one thing. And then after that, then you've got the physical training, and then mental. You know, learn as much as you can about skills and how to be more resourceful, because skills weigh nothing. You can always take those with you anywhere you go, and nobody can steal them from you. So that's your first step, is yourself taking care of your mental, physical, and spiritual preparedness. The next thing you want to do, we're still not getting into the beans, bullets, and band-aids of it yet. The next thing you want to do is get on a budget, because more than likely our next crisis is going to be financial in nature. And in the last Great Recession, which you just mentioned, you know, we still haven't really come out of it. You know, we've got 5.5% in unemployment, but there's 94 million people of working age,
right,
that are not in the labor force right now. That's how we get that fake number, is by not counting that 94 million people, which is close to a third of the population of America.
That's right.
And so for them, the financial crisis is still going on, because there's not 94 million people in America that retired early because things were just so prosperous and they'd made so much money in the past 8 years that they could just drop out and stay home. A lot of those people are students that have got huge student loan debt that, you know, they can't find a job that's worth triggering their debt repayment.
Yeah.
So they just stay in mom's basement and play video games until something better comes along. And they've never entered the workforce. So they can't be counted as unemployment because they've never been employed. Mm-hmm. And lots of kids that are coming out of high school that they can't get the McDonald's job anymore because, you know, there's a guy with a Bachelor of Arts flipping burgers. So it's really, really bad. And you need to be ready for that personal stuff hits the fan moment by being financially prepared yourself, and being on a budget's the best way to do that, and putting aside emergency fund. And if you're living on a budget and you're saving money towards an emergency fund and stuff goes bad, you've already got a reduced standard of living because a portion of your money that you were making was already going to your emergency fund.
Right.
So, and your savings. So it's going to be less of an impact on you. If you're already not spending $5 a day on Boca Chocolata lattes or whatever, and, you know, you're gonna feel less of a crunch when you have to tighten your belt. If your hours get cut, or if you have to take a lower paying job, or whatever the case happens to be, or you get laid off completely and you have to start living on that emergency fund that you've been putting to the side, you're gonna be more well adjusted for it. After that, then you can start thinking about the stuff that we typically start thinking of as being survival preparedness stuff. That the first thing I would say to do is put together a bug out bag, something that will sustain life for 72 hours. And you're not jump starting society, so keep it light, keep it simple. You need some way to purify water. You need 3 days worth of food in there. You need maybe a jacket and a change of socks, t-shirt, and underwear. A good cutting tool, perhaps a good multi-tool, some type of shelter. People put a lot of stuff in their bug out bags. And, you know, if you're in a northern climate, you need some type of shelter in there. You need, and I recommend like a space blanket, not the little Mylar thing that looks like a piece of aluminum foil, mm-hmm. but a real space blanket, which, you know, you'll know the difference because they cost a little more. The real space blanket's around $15, and those little Mylar things are about $1. So, get the real space blanket, which will conserve body heat, and it's got a reflective side, usually a colored side. And then some type of shelter, either a tarp. And if you're going to get a tarp, you need to really be sure that you know how to construct a shelter out of a tarp. But I would recommend a small tent, mm-hmm. and get something that's small. It's just enough to keep you out of the elements, because the survival rule of three says you can make it for about 3 minutes without air, only about 3 hours without shelter in bad conditions, because you get hypothermia, and that takes a lot of people out. So you have to have some type of shelter, and then three days without water. So that's why you want to have that water purification, and about 3 weeks without food. So food's actually kind of farther down the list of needs than shelter and water.
And I'm actually prepping for that in sort of a very economical way. I'm just carrying it around with me the extra, you know, week or two. So I'm probably good for about 28 days. So,
yeah, I've got a little extra myself that I've been trying to take care of lately.
Well, let me ask you a practical question of purifying water. I mean, it's good to say, okay, you need some means of purifying water, but how do we do that? I mean, I was born and raised in Chicago. For me, water comes out of the tap. You know, I don't know from one water source to another. I have no clue. So what would I carry in a bug out bag to purify water that I find in a hole or a pond or something if we're having to rough it?
Katahdin makes a really good handheld filter, pump filter.
Katahdin?
They make one that's called the Hiker Pro, and it's less than $100. It's about $75, and it'll purify about 500, 800 gallons. They've got another one for about $250 that will purify several thousand gallons without changing the filter. But for a bug out bag, because like I said, you're not trying to restart society. You just want to survive for 3 days. That's the goal of that bag. And I think the Hiker Pro is perfect for that, because it's not quite as expensive as the higher price model, and it'll do what it needs to do. Mm-hmm. If that's too much, you know, you can get the tablets, the purification tablets. You can get those on Amazon or wherever, and you can drop those in. But they've got kind of a funny taste, and you know, it's not really going to take out the sediment, and it's not going to take out a lot of the stuff. It'll make it safe to drink, but it won't make it taste good. Mm-hmm. The Katahdin hand pump Hiker Pro, that's gonna pump out something out of a stream or a pond or whatever the water source you can find, and it's gonna make pure, clean, clear water. And of course, pre-filtering that to the best of your ability is gonna make your filter last longer.
Okay, so don't scoop up the mud off the bottom if you can help it. Just
right.
You know, stick it in the clear part of the water and then pump it through the filter. So 3 days worth of food. Given that you're trying to travel light, what would you recommend for 72 hours worth of food?
For the bug out bag, I don't think MREs are a bad choice. They're a little bit more expensive, and I don't stock up MREs for my long-term storage food for my house, but that's what I keep in my bug out bag, and that's the only thing I buy MREs for because they are pretty expensive, but they're very handy. You don't have to worry about rotating them out every year because they last quite a long time. If you're looking for a cheaper way to stock up a bug out bag with a few things that'll just keep you alive, granola bars are great, but their expiration date's usually a year or two out, and they won't go bad, but they start to fall apart and they start to lose part of their texture and their flavor after their expiration date. Another good thing that's cheap to put in a bug out bag is like the Chef Boyardee stuff, like SpaghettiOs Chef Boyardee raviolis. And make sure that you don't get the pull tops. Because the pull tops, they're perforated, and they don't have quite as good of a seal as just the regular can that you have to open with a can opener. So now you want to make sure you got a can opener in your bag, too.
Yes.
Probably two in case one breaks or you lose one or you can't find one. Mm-hmm. So that's one of those good things, especially if that's your only food source. You want to have two ways to open it.
Yeah, opening a can with an axe takes a real skill.
It sure does. But the Chef Boyardee's, they got a lot of fat, they got a lot of carbs, they got a lot of carbohydrates, which in a normal situation is not really what you're looking for. But in a survival situation, that's getting the most bang for your buck. That's getting a lot of calories, a lot of energy in a small space that doesn't take up a lot of weight.
And the cutting tool. Now, are you talking about an axe here? Axe or saw or some sort of multi-tool that can serve a number of functions?
Yeah, I really like for folks to have a good multi-tool. Of course, Leatherman, they make the Cadillacs, but Gerber makes a really good, reliable multi-tool as well. And you just want to make sure you've got all the basics on there. You've got the pliers and wire cutters and a knife and a little saw and a regular screwdriver and Phillips head. It doesn't have to be super fancy. And Gerber's, for their price, they're usually around – you can get a good one for around $30 or $40. They're very, very reliable. Whereas if you get one from the dollar store, it's going to fall apart the next day.
Yeah, yeah. Just for some basics, one of the comments that we've had, and I think we're going to look to do this next year at Skywatch TV, people asking about where to start, because it sounds like an overwhelming task. Okay, it's all well and good for Mark Goodwin to tell me all of this stuff. He's got his own website and he's built up this whole thing and he's got all of the stuff that he could ever need. I've got nothing. And when people start looking at what they would need for a bug out bag or for long-term stored food for themselves, it's almost like people who find themselves in a house that's cluttered and they don't know where to start with the decluttering. And so the clutter just grows and grows and grows and never gets fixed. It's almost that daunting when looking at how do we begin prepping, especially if we're on a budget. There's so much that we need to get. I don't know where to start, and so I never start. What would you recommend as a first step for somebody beginning the process?
Yeah, well, we started with personal preparedness and the spiritual preparedness. Jesus paid the price for that, so that's free to us.
Okay, well, I can check that one off my box. Okay,
yeah,
check that
and
box.
And then the physical preparedness. You can, it doesn't cost anything to get out and walk. Mm-hmm. It doesn't cost anything to do push-ups. Most people have internet. If they're listening to you, they've got some type of internet access. You can go on YouTube. You can watch some cardio kickboxing classes, and that'll take care of your cardio, and it'll take care of some of your self-defense side as well. Your budget. That's actually going to save you money. Mm-hmm. Start clipping coupons, and my wife keeps the coupon corner page up on PrepperRecon.com. And that's got a lot of great tips for couponing. And we, when we first started out, we were on a really, really tight budget, but we kept on that tight budget. And she stocked up our pantry to the point that we had 6 months worth of storage food without spending any extra money besides just what we have for our regular grocery budget through couponing and a lot of buy one, get one free deals and manufacturer coupons paired with store coupons paired with buy one, get one free deals. And we just we really, really stocked up for absolutely no extra money whatsoever. For if you want to jump start your long-term food storage plan, the cheapest way to do that is beans and rice. Of course, mm-hmm. you have to eat beans and rice. If you're buying stuff that you don't know how to cook and you don't eat, it's not really going to do any good.
But yeah.
we just recently moved out of South Florida, and that's a big staple in South Florida is beans and rice. I love beans and rice. I love black beans and white beans and red beans.
Beans and
I love rice.
Yeah.
And rice, you can get a 20-pound bag of rice at Walmart for $8.50. You can get the dollar store has pounds of beans for a dollar, but then Walmart also has they've got beans for they start around $1.16 for the black beans and red beans, and they go up to maybe $1.50 a pound for some of the other beans. But rice will store for 20 years, the white rice. You don't want to get the brown rice. It's still got it's the best for you, the brown rice, but only buy the amount of brown rice that you're going to eat in a year mm-hmm. because it's still got the bran on it. It's got the fatty acids in there, and that will go rancid, mm-hmm. whereas the white rice will store for 20 years. And then your beans will store anywhere from 5 to 10 years, depending on the type and how you're storing them. And one of the easiest way to store them is to go to Home Depot, buy a bucket, just throw the whole bag of rice right in that bucket, and cap it off with a lid. Put 10 pounds of you can probably fit about 10 pounds of beans in there, or 8 pounds if you want to throw in a thing of salt and a thing of baking soda, which I would recommend putting in that bucket, and then cap that off. And that's good to store for at least 5 years if you've got it out in the garage in the heat with the beans in it. So it'll cost you $8 for the 20-pound bag of rice, and then a dollar or two for 8 pounds of beans each. So now we're at like $16. A thing of salt's 50 cents and a thing of baking soda is 50 cents. So for $17, you've got about 2 or 3 weeks worth of food in that bucket. And you cap that off and you don't have to worry about it. And now you can just keep stacking those things up in an empty corner in your garage. And one of the reasons I said to put baking soda in there is because when you're going to have to cook all of this stuff, and if you're in a grid down situation, you know, fuel might be hard to come by, even if you're, you know, chopping wood or whatever.
Right.
And if you put a tablespoon of baking soda in your beans the night before when you soak them, you'll cut your cook time in half on those dried beans.
Oh, okay.
And it also makes them more digestible for folks that have trouble digesting beans.
Yeah.
And baking soda's got a lot of uses. You can brush your teeth with it. You
yes.
can use it for deodorant. You can wash your hair with it. So that's just a great thing to stock anyway, but it's a great, great reason to have it in that bucket with your beans, with your rice, with your salt.
Good.
And you don't want to put your salt in your beans until after they're finished cooking, because that will slow down the cooking time. And you know, resources is going to be a big thing. Cooking in the apocalypse is going to send up smoke. So you're going to be giving us smoke signals. Hey, I've got food. Hey, I've got a fire. Hey, there's people over here.
Yeah.
One of the ways you can address that, and it's a little bit more expensive, but a sun oven. They've got directions online where you can build your own sun oven, but the professionally manufactured ones are much, much more efficient. But you know, we cooked an entire meal of chicken, beans and rice in a solar oven in a matter of about 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, I just saw the link to that on your website there, prepperrecon.com, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes, of course, at vftb.net. That is really intriguing, and that's a good point, too, because if things do go bad, and this is a point that Carl Gallup's addressed, and, of course, his new book, Be Thou Prepared, is all about the need to prepare, not just for a situation where you can't get to the store, but also situations of social unrest, which can be triggered by a number of things, an economic collapse, but also something like Hurricane Katrina, which you mentioned, Mark. And if you are a little too open about advertising that you've got stuff, you may attract people that you hadn't planned on serving. One of the reasons, of course, that we prepare is so that we've got extra to share with those in need during a time of crisis. But sometimes people will just invite themselves and decide to help themselves if they are able. The One of the comments that we received after the Carl Gallup's interviews was, look, I don't need to prepare because I know we're going to be raptured out of here before things get really bad. I know what Carl said to that comment, how he addressed it. Mark, how would you address that sentiment?
Well, it didn't work out for Kim Davis, did it? She spent 6 days without work. It didn't work out for Aaron Klein and his wife out in Oregon. They lost their job. They lost their business. I had Aaron on the show shortly after Sweet Cakes went out of business because they were sued out of business for not baking the cake for the homosexual couple. And he is somewhat self-sufficient. He's got a little micro farm. He grows food. He's got animals on there, but he's got a whole bunch of kids that he has to provide for. And, you know, he had to go back. He had to take a job on a garbage truck. You know, what are you going to do when you're sued out of business, when you get canned from your job, because you won't sign, some form that basically rubber stamps homosexual marriages. You know, it didn't work out. Those people didn't get raptured. The people in Louisiana after Katrina, they didn't get raptured. Right. The people in New York after Hurricane Sandy, you know, very affluent people digging through dumpsters because they didn't listen. They didn't listen to the government's call to either evacuate or get prepared.
Mm-hmm.
We're digging through dumpsters looking for food, and they didn't get raptured.
That's exactly the point. Jesus will come in his own good time, but until that day, there will still be earthquakes, there will still be tornadoes, there will still be hurricanes that have nothing whatsoever to do with social unrest or the timing of the apocalypse. Just being prepared, as Carl Gallup's discussed, for any eventuality allowed him and his family to be of help to others in need after Hurricane Ike. It was Ivan. Ivan was the one that did the kind of loop-de-loop. It crossed Florida, went up, and then crossed Florida again and went into the Gulf of Mexico. What are you going to do when things are the rug is pulled out from underneath you? Well, that's where Josh Tolley's book, Evangelpreneur, which offended some people because you're combining the words evangelize and entrepreneur. just being prepared to be flexible and find a way to provide for your family, which is a biblical command, in a way.
And the Bible tells us to work hard with our hands so that we'll have something to share with others.
Exactly right.
You know,
exactly.
So poverty doesn't really allow you to do that. So taking a vow of poverty and thinking that you're doing the Lord's will by being poor, there's certain commands you're not going to be able to fulfill if that's your outlet.
Yeah. Coming back around to your book and the series, The Days of Noah, the new book three, Perdition. Mark, what do you hope the takeaway is for readers of those novels?
Well, without giving too much of a spoiler, mm-hmm. The Days of Noah was written. The entire trilogy was written as the sort of it leads up to the rapture. And because there's been books written about, you know, what does the earth look like after the day after the rapture happens?
Right.
But there's no books that have really been written about what does the world look like the day before the rapture.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I wanted to do. And I wanted to, while I've kind of taken a little bit of what you said about being a pan-tribist to where I think it'll all pan out. I'm not sure exactly when Jesus is going to come back as far as the timeline. But I wrote this from a pre-tribulation viewpoint, it's actually sort of a hybrid pre-wrath viewpoint, I guess is what you would probably call it. But what I wanted to do is show people exactly how bad it could get in America before the return of Christ and still hold to something of a sort of a pre-wrath, pre-trib type eschatological viewpoint. And another thing I wanted to do is, as in all my books, I like to provide some good, clean Christian entertainment, and because there's not a lot of that out there. the movies and Hollywood and everything. Everything's got an agenda. Everything's so much propaganda, and it's and part of that propaganda is to just fill your mind and your head with filth. And you know, it's a garbage in, garbage out. And the Christian church is so willing and so ready to compromise and to go see movies where God's name's used in vain. And there's so much, you know, just borderline pornography in the movies.
Yeah.
And even just the television shows where God's name's used in vain and F-bombs and everything else. And there's not a whole lot of good choices for Christian entertainment. So I wanted to provide that, put a good message in there, provide some good action that you pointed out at the beginning of the show.
Lots of explosions.
There's some action in this one.
Yeah.
But for the ladies also, there's a lot of connectivity between the characters as well. Mm-hmm. So I get a lot of female, I probably have more female readers than male readers, which kind of surprised me. In my first series in the Economic Collapse Chronicles, but I guess the ladies like it too. So, you know, and so there's a lot in there for them as well. But like you said, there is some action.
Yeah.
And I wanted it to be entertaining, and I wanted to provide that. But then I also wanted to put some good prepper tips in all of my books as well. So I always try to sneak in some stuff in there to where you think about, what's this character doing? What's the situation he's in? How would I handle it if I was in Noah's situation right now, or if I was in Cassie's situation right now? How would I handle that? Am I equipped to handle that situation? Do I have the skills I need to get through this predicament? Do I have the preps that I would need to survive such a situation?
And often, as we've seen with books like Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code and Angels and Demons and The Lost Symbol, you can influence people on a deeper level sometimes with fiction than you can with works of nonfiction. I deeply appreciate the work of people like, I keep using his name, so this is no surprise, Dr. Michael Heiser, others who are writing works of nonfiction that are scholarly works of theology. But the fact is, most average folk out there aren't going to read it, or if they read it, they're just not going to get it because they're coming from a different place. That's fine. It doesn't make them bad people, but you get it in a good story. And even those of us who enjoy reading a good theological work get caught up in a story. And as Dan Brown showed, I mean, you know, suddenly a flood of people showing up at say Roslyn Chapel in Scotland looking for the Holy Grail. Based on a work of fiction, because for some reason, fiction affects us at a deeper level than works of nonfiction. We're less skeptical, and especially if we care about the characters, which you do in the days of Noah, you care about what they're doing, you're kind of paying attention to what's going on, and you're going to absorb stuff that you might not if it was just a dry, you know, here is a book on preparedness by Mark Goodwin. So I think it's a very intelligent way of getting that out there. You've also got some theological stuff out there and also some very insightful political observations about things that have taken place and are taking place in America today. So very well written and, again, a very exciting read. The Days of Noah, books 1 through 3, now available. Where's the best place for people to go if they want to get a copy of the book, Mark?
Amazon.com.
Okay, I'll link to that in the show notes as well at vftb.net. And your podcast, Prepper Recon, that is at prepperrecon.com?
That's right, prepperrecon.com. We put a new preparedness-related podcast up every Monday and Wednesday. Sunday, we try to do a little Bible study to, you know, especially if you're in a sleepy or apostate church, you're probably not getting it from the pulpit. But if you're not, you know what? You need to get out there and do the research and find somebody that's speaking the truth, because that's the real reason this nation is in the situation that it's in. We took prayer out of the school. And that went by, and we took the Bible out of school, and we've been slaughtering babies, and now we've got gay marriage on the books, and now guess what? Now we're going to jail. Christians are going to jail. So now, if you're a Christian in America, you're officially a criminal now. Mm-hmm. So it's way too late. you know, the hours is at hand, and it's time to stand up and start getting involved. Start praying. You know, you asked me, you know, what can we do? Can we do, you know, is it time for a military revolution? And like I said, I don't really think that would do any good at this point. And I think that the only thing we can really do right now is pray for your pastors and talk to your pastors. And if they're not willing to get in the fight on a spiritual level and to start calling their congregants to pray and fast and get on their knees for this nation and stand up and be ready for the persecution that's coming. If they're not ready to do that, it's time to get out and find a church that is ready to do that. And if you're in that church, then pray for your pastor, because he's coming under a spiritual attack, and you know, the devil's doing everything he can to take those pastors out and get them out of the way. Mm-hmm. And more than likely, he's going to end up coming under either a financial or a criminal attack from the government, because that's it. We have been criminalized now. And if you're a Christian and you're in America, you're a criminal. So you need to start preparing and thinking like that. You need to start, if you're not in a home group, if you're not in a home fellowship, you need to get in a home fellowship right now, because I think pretty soon that's going to be the only church you're going to have, unless you're going to Joel Osteen's church and you're among the apostate churches that are rubber stamping and saying, okay, we're going to go right along with whatever the government says. If you're not willing to do that, then your church is probably going to end up getting closed down pretty soon. They have to go through that in the days of Noah, and that's what they do, is they have the home fellowship, but they already had that. So, you know, it was sort of a they were able to just flow right into that. So if you're not in a home fellowship, you definitely need to get into that and start building your networking skills and start thinking like a Chinese Christian, or start thinking like a Saudi Arabia Christian or an Iranian Christian or a Afghanistan Christian, and start thinking like you're part of a persecuted church, because you are, and start moving and talking and communicating and practicing all of those skills, because this is not going to go away.
Hmm. Mark Goodwin is the author of the new book, Days of Noah, Book 3, Perdition. He's also the host of the Prepper Recon podcast online at PrepperRecon.com. Mark, thanks for the tips. Thanks for the advice. And thank you for sharing the book. Really enjoy it. Available both in paperback and Kindle, by the way. And since we subscribe to Kindle Unlimited, we get a really good deal on it. Again, links to those in the show notes. Mark, we'll talk again.
Derek, thank you so much for having me back on the show. And the audiobook should be out by October 1st.
Fantastic. You'll find the show notes at vftb.net. And of course, there's a link to Mark Goodwin's website, the Prepper Recon Podcast, where you can follow his work, both with the written word and the spoken word. Some rip-roaring fiction with some good prepper teeps in it. Prepper fiction, a new genre. Mark Goodwin kind of leading the charge there with the Days of Noah series. And you'll find a link to the book at Amazon as well, if you're interested in picking up a copy of that. And as I mentioned, if you are a subscriber to Amazon Prime, as Sharon and I are, the book is available through the Kindle Unlimited program, which is pretty cool, because as long as you're a subscriber, you have access to the Kindle Unlimited titles at no charge. I mean, you're paying the annual fee for Amazon Prime, but we buy enough from Amazon that just getting the free shipping more than pays for the annual fee. And you get some nice bonuses there too, like some streaming video. And of course, the Amazon Prime subscribers get the Kindle Unlimited for Kindle owners as well, which so we're taking good advantage of that. So in the news from the Middle East, as I record this on Thursday, September 24th, 2015, over 700 killed in a stampede at the Hajj. That's the annual pilgrimage to Mecca, where Muslims go to venerate that big black rock. They've had some real trouble there this year. Just a couple of weeks ago, a crane at the Grand Mosque, they were doing some expansion work at the Grand Mosque in Mecca, and a crane collapsed, killed over 100 people, several hundred were wounded. This stampede took place earlier today, and I think the official toll, last time I checked, which was about 2 hours ago, so early afternoon Central Time on Thursday the 24th, was 717 dead, which I believe is the second deadliest stampede. These happen every few years in Mecca, because they get 2 million, an estimated 2 million in Mecca for this event every year. and they're all trying to jam into the same place at the same time. And when you're in that kind of a crowd, things can turn ugly very quickly. I've only been in one situation where I was literally afraid for my life because of the crush of people around me. And this was when I was young and stupid and decided to go to New Orleans for Mardi Gras. Now, New Orleans at Mardi Gras time is like an adult amusement park. And by I mean adult in the same sense as, like, you know, no one under 21 allowed. Again, young, stupid, a different place in my life than I am now. And it was Mardi Gras night, that Tuesday night on Bourbon Street. And I was crushed up against a building with a friend of mine, literally could not move, couldn't even raise my arms. And I began to panic. I'm not normally claustrophobic, but I began to panic. So I get a slight sense of what it must have been like for the pilgrims in Mecca. So tragic. The Hajj is something that's required of able-bodied Muslims once in their lifetime. And again, 2 million there this year, and 717 dead as of last check, and that number may climb as the situation gets sorted out. Obviously, the Saudis profit from the pilgrimage. People go there. They've got to have places to live, places to stay. Some of the tragedies that have occurred there in the last couple of decades included hostels where people were staying, just collapsing due to the number of people inside the building. So pretty serious situation there. In Syria, you may have heard that Russia has been moving military hardware and personnel into the country to help the government of Bashar al-Assad fend off the Islamic State and other rebel groups. Once again, Vladimir Putin has outmaneuvered the government of the United States, the administration of Barack Obama. Over the weekend, they essentially extended a helping hand and invited the United States to join their coalition in the fight against the Islamic State. What this means is that with the Russians getting involved, and according to Debka file today, by the way, the Russians sent a group of Marines into battle against the Islamic State today alongside Hezbollah, which, of course, is the Iranian proxy group that's been fighting alongside the Assad government for a couple of years now. And, of course, whenever they're not fighting the Islamic State, they turn around and they fight Israel. Well, anyway, the Russians have said to the Americans, hey, look, you know, Islamic State, they're bad guys, evil. How about joining us in this coalition here? Well, what this means is that the government of Assad is now, and Secretary of State Kerry has admitted this, not going to fall anytime soon. The government of Bashar al-Assad is not going to fall, not going to collapse anytime soon. So Barack Obama now has a couple of choices. He can direct his administration to reject the Russian invitation, which means that all of the pronouncements we've made about the Islamic State being an evil organization is just a bunch of hooey, and that it would basically expose the truth, which is that we really didn't want to defeat the Islamic State until after it had taken care of Assad for us. Or we can join them, either clip the wings of the Islamic State or wipe it out. But, of course, that means that Bashar al-Assad and his government remain in power, which is what the Russians want, because their only port access to the Mediterranean is at, Tarsus in Syria. So this also creates issues for Israel, by the way. Benjamin Netanyahu and a group of military leaders from Israel traveled to the Kremlin on Monday of this week for meetings with Vladimir Putin and the military colleagues or counterparts in Russia. The fact that the Russian Air Force now has a presence in Syria means that Israel no longer has a free hand to interrupt the flow of weapons from Iran through Syria to Hezbollah in Lebanon. So there are some implications here for Israel. Even though the Islamic State hasn't targeted Israel yet, they're more interested in wiping out the Shia and the apostate Sunnis in the Middle East before they turn their attention to Israel. I believe the Islamic State, based on the experts that I've talked to and read, that the Saudis have more to worry about from the Islamic State than Israel does. Truth. The Islamic State would like to have possession of Mecca and Medina just because it would give them legitimacy throughout the entire Muslim world. And that's why the Saudis have been building a border fence along the border with Iraq, along Anbar province, which basically belongs to the Islamic State now. Anyway, so things are getting interesting in Syria. This was kind of an interesting side note to what's going on there. The war in Syria has led to the very first withdrawal ever from the global seed vault, which is in the Arctic, buried underneath snow and ice on Svalbard Island, which is between Norway and Greenland. An organization called the International Center for Agricultural Research in Dry Areas, or ICARDA, which was headquartered in the city of Aleppo. That's in northern Syria, not far from that town, Dabiq, where the Islamic State believes the cataclysmic battle will take place between Islam and the forces of Christendom, Rome. They wanted some of their samples back, or at least to withdraw some of the samples that they had deposited at the Global Seed Vault to replace ones that have been destroyed in the war. I just thought that was a little bit interesting. And one final note, this is, two final notes. First of all, I thought this was just an interesting archaeological note. Researchers in Israel think that they found the tomb of the Maccabees. All we really know about the Maccabees is that there were a couple of books named after them in the Apocrypha. First Maccabees, Second Maccabees. They were the group that ruled Israel when the Jews, or Judea really, when they revolted against the Greek rulers of the Seleucid Empire. Antiochus Epiphanes, who was or Antiochus the Fourth, who was a type of Antichrist. The Greek rulers basically put a stop to the Jewish religious practices in the temple, defiled the temple, in fact. The abomination that causes desolation. Well, the Maccabees led a successful revolt, and Judea was independent for a little while. And then the Romans came in at the invitation of one of the political parties that was on the way out. So much for Jewish independence. But anyway, archaeologists think that they found the tomb of the Maccabees. That announcement made earlier this week, and dig is ongoing. And one final note, PETA, which apparently now stands for Profiting Every Trial Attorney, has filed a suit in court on behalf of a macaque monkey named Naruto. Naruto lives in Indonesia and apparently about 4 years ago grabbed a camera from a photographer and took a selfie. At least that's the claim. Photographer David Slater was on the island of Sulawesi in 2011 when the monkey grabbed the camera and clicked. It's really a funny picture because the monkey looks like he's giving a great big old smile. The photograph has been posted to the internet since then, and PETA has decided to sue on behalf of Naruto, saying that using the monkey's image because he took the picture, using his picture without his consent, is a violation of his rights. Now, beyond the fact that this is ridiculous, I mean, it's a monkey, okay, first of all. Secondly, he lives on Indonesia. Why does he even have standing to sue in an American court? Thirdly, how can PETA prove that they even know Naruto or are friends with Naruto, have standing to file suit on his behalf? How can we even identify the monkey? How do we know Naruto is really his name in monkey language? Okay, setting all that aside. Oh, and beside the fact, too, that the U.S. Copyright Office actually says it will not register or copyright a photograph taken by a monkey. That's actually in the code. So setting all that aside, this is another attack on human exceptionalism, the idea that we humans have unique value simply because we are created in God's image, that we are God's imagers, his moral agents on planet Earth. And radicals like PETA and other animal rights activists will keep prodding and testing the courts until some judge somewhere is persuaded to grant personhood status on an animal. The fundamental concept being that humans are not exceptional, that we are simply one animal among many on planet Earth and that there is no such thing as human rights. There are only personal rights, which should apply to any being, whether it's human, simian, aquatic, or artificial, above a certain level of cognition. In other words, if you can think beyond a certain level, then you are entitled to personal rights. Now, there are some animal lovers who might say, well, that sounds reasonable. Monkeys, gorillas do have a certain level of cognitive ability that should be recognized, and perhaps they should be protected. But that's animal welfare, not animal rights. Okay? Yes, let's take care of animals, be good stewards of the creation that God, into which God placed us. But let's not confuse animal welfare with animal rights. Because the dark side of creating this concept of personhood, which could apply to any entity above a certain level of cognition, is that while it would create non-human persons, it would also create non-person humans. And so people who've suffered head trauma, people with certain developmental disabilities, could be considered non-persons under the law and thus not entitled to protection under the law. And that is a dangerous road to travel. So when stories like this come up, don't just laugh them off. And be prepared to explain why this is an important issue to your friends and colleagues. Coming up on A View from the Bunker this weekend, parenting in the land of Moloch. If the United States is not a land dedicated to the false god or the fallen angel known as Moloch, then I don't know what is. Some 60 million killed in the womb since Roe v. Wade. In fact, Dr. Chuck Missler, during an interview last week, told me something that I had never really considered. The most dangerous place for an American today is in the mother's womb. Not Ramadi in Iraq, not the streets of Chicago, but in the mother's womb. And in fact, in New York City, it's even more dangerous. He said, on average, in America today, an unborn child has a 20% chance of being killed before birth. But in New York City, according to statistics from 2013, the percentage is much higher. It's about 1 in 3. And if you're an African-American baby in the womb, it's better than 50-50 that you'll be killed before you come to full term and are born. Doug Overmeyer of Seer's Sea Ministries, seerssea.com, joins us. We talk with him about what it's like to be a good parent in the land of Moloch today. On the 30th, next week, Wednesday, Dr. Michael Heiser talks about his book, The Unseen Realm. This is the culmination of years of work, and it distills his research into the divine counsel paradigm, drawing on scripture and using it to illustrate the true nature of the spirit realm that surrounds us. It's a really interesting book and an important book for your reference library. That interview will be posted next Wednesday, September 30th. And then, let me see, what are the days after that? It's October 2nd, I believe. Got to look at a calendar. Anyway, the first Sunday in October, L.A. Marzulli joins us again, and we discuss his forthcoming DVD, Watchers 9, number 9 in the Watchers DVD series. That, of course, also coinciding with the release of his book, Days of Chaos, which will be out, that'll be October 4th, I guess. Yeah, October 4th, I believe. Anyway, first Sunday in November, L.A. Marzulli joins us on A View from the Bunker, which is a production of Gilbert House. And released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. The opening theme is by Kevin MacLeod, www.incompetech.com. We wrestle not against flesh and blood. I'm Derek Gilbert, and this is A View from the Bunker.